Hi, it's Patrick Cox here with another episode of The World in Words, stories about languages and the people who speak them. I went to see a guy in the Netherlands recently, a man who can pronounce his name many different ways.
Personally, I say Gaston Doren. When I introduce myself in English, I would say Gaston Doren. Many Dutch speakers would say Gaston Doren.
Now, there's a certain type of English speaker who might freak out over this. Isn't there a correct pronunciation? What's with all these variations? Well, there are more. There's Limburgish, for example. That's the dialect that this guy grew up with.
Gaston Doren. When I say that way, I can hear my mother speak, so I suppose, yes, that would be the Limburgish pronunciation. Gaston Doren.
Today, we're going to speak languages, a lot of languages, with Gaston Doren. He speaks six languages. He writes about many more. Though to my knowledge, he hasn't written about Klingon. Klingon, and who owns it? That's coming up later in the podcast. Back now to Gaston's name. And he's not done with it.
I used to have a German grandmother-in-law who would say Gaston Doren. And in Spanish, they would say Gaston Doren.
I don't think I've ever come across anybody who's got a name that could be pronounced in so many ways. When you said it at first, the way that you pronounce it, you dropped the N at the end, right? It sounded almost French.
I made it nasal. Gaston. That's how the French pronounce it. And it is a French name, so that's why I sort of keep it that way.
Well, I think I should keep it the English way. Just today, anyway. Gaston, as you'll hear, is completely at home in a multilingual world. And that's sort of fascinating to me. I mean, I live in pretty much a monolingual world. I think most of us native English speakers do. Well, Gaston, he grew up speaking one language at home, another at school, and the third, fourth, and fifth, they just followed, seemingly naturally. So the home language, that's perhaps the most obscure one, Limburgish.
And what is Limburgish and who speaks it?
Limburgish is the regional language spoken in much of the Dutch province of Limburg and also the Belgian province of Limburg. It's spoken by, I guess, about a million or so people.
A million people? And I'd barely heard of it. The thing is, Limburgish isn't organized like languages often are. No one's gone on the record and said, this is Limburgish and that isn't. Instead, it's just a floating collection of dialects, which makes it fun. No one's going to correct you. You can be super creative with that.
I spoke it every day up to my 18th birthday. I mean, until I left the region. I would speak it not in class, because there you would speak proper Dutch, but in the schoolyard and with friends, with most friends anyway, in shops, and it was the language of daily communication.
But geographically, Limburgish is hemmed in. Other languages are all around. There's Dutch, of course, that's everywhere. And there's German, less than 20 miles away from where Gaston grew up. And French, not much further. At school, though, Gaston learned in Dutch, which is why, for a while, Dutch had a kind of formality to it in Gaston's mind. Limburgish was closer to his heart. But over time, that changed.
I've never even had a relationship with a Limburgish woman, so all my intimate life has been, well, either German, actually, or Dutch, but never Limburgish. I suppose that makes a difference, too.
Limburgish is somewhere in between Dutch and German. Not just the pronunciation and the vocab, but the grammar. It's a mix. In that part of Europe, there's a lot of mixing.
When I was nearly 15, I fell in love with a German girl. And since I had some German, learned at school, and she had no Dutch, we usually spoke German. And, well, as we all know, a relationship or love is the best way to learn a language.
So, German, Dutch, Limburgish. Gaston was effortlessly trilingual. It was just the linguistic facts on the ground. Spanish followed, there was time spent in Latin America, and English was always in the background.
When I got my first job, where I noticed that having Spanish is useful, but having English is more useful, I set out to improve my English. And actually, I became very friendly with a native English speaker. The idea was that I would teach her Dutch and she would teach me English, but the first bit never worked out.
So often the way non-native English speakers learn English because it's almost a necessity. Like, it gives them the keys to the house. The other way round, for us English speakers to learn another language, it's not the same. We already have the keys to the house. Learning Dutch or any other language, that's our basement conversion or garden shed. If it doesn't work out, we'll still have the house. Gaston, though, he made sure he had the key to the front door.
Living in Holland, I need a lot of English. I mean, reading books, internet nowadays, I listen to podcasts and audiobooks, and all of that is in English. And since my book was translated into English, I have more direct contact with the English-speaking world.
Gaston's book, by the way, is called Lingo. It's a series of short chapters, each about a European language or some aspect of it. It's a great read. Now, there are European languages, and then there are languages spoken in Europe. Gaston learned about some of them when he lived in the big city, Amsterdam.
I mean, I would go to this Ethiopian restaurant like once a month. I had a Moroccan neighbor who spoke Arabic and also Berber, if I remember correctly. So yes, I was aware that there was this linguistic diversity, these linguistic riches right at my doorstep, and I didn't know the first thing about them. Well, I knew what they looked like. I mean, you would see the Arabic script, and there was this Turkish travel agent which would offer trips to Izmir and Istanbul, and to my surprise, he would put a dot on top of the capital I, and I wondered, why is that? And the Ethiopian guy would write in their script, Happy New Year and Merry Christmas, well, vice versa. And it looked amazing. So yeah, I wanted to know more about that. That's how it started.
And how? What did it teach you? Not just about the languages, but about the people.
About the people? Frankly, and this is a bit of an embarrassing statement, not all that much. But that is not saying anything about the languages, it's more saying something about myself. I'm really interested in the languages, and obviously I'm interested in people generally. But unlike much of the linguistic journalism that you do, which is very much about society and individuals and their history, which I admire and like listening to, I'm not very good at that. I'm more into the mechanics of language and the sounds and the grammars and the history. And it's really a different flavor of language writing.
So Gaston gets all obsessed about scripts and alphabets and diacritical signs, like those dots over some Turkish vowels. And he studied 8 of these Amsterdam immigrant languages, which taught him what exactly?
What it taught me, well, we talked about Limburgish earlier on, and when I was in my teens, I began to compare the two linguistic systems, the two languages that I had in my head, the Limburgish and the Dutch system, and I found all these differences and similarities. Now, I took that one step further when I did these 8 languages, which I never spoke, right? I mean, I only read about them. And I saw that these small differences between Limburgish and Dutch would sort of translate into huge, but somehow similar differences between Dutch or English and these languages from all over the world. Because in the end, all languages have to do the same thing. I mean, they are there to enable person A to make something clear to person B. And to do that, they have to have recognizable sounds, and they have to say, look, this is the thing I'm talking about, this is the other thing I'm talking about, and this is the relationship between those two things. And therefore, they have grammar and phonology and vocabulary. And every language, even those languages like Turkish and Papiamentu and Kurdish, have to find solutions to solve those problems. So in the end, there's always a point of comparison. But in the meantime, you come across the most amazing differences.
Right. Do you see certain things and you think, gosh, I wish Dutch had that? The ability to do that, either in the writing system or in the grammar.
There is one thing in English. Actually, what I'm going to say will irritate some listeners because I know that it's a controversial thing, but I love the ability of English to verb nouns. I think most languages do that to a degree, but English is particularly flexible at that. And I love it.
And Dutch can't do that.
Well, there is one thing, there's one characteristic, one feature of Dutch that English doesn't have, or no longer has, I should say, and that is to make a verb, we have to add a suffix. And to make a verb that sounds convincing or sounds natural, we often also have to add a prefix. So you end up with a longer word, and it will not always work. Not all nouns will lend themselves to being verbed. For instance, I find there's a word for holidays or vacation in Dutch, which is simply vakantie. And I find it hard to imagine turning that into a verb. I mean, that would be something like vakantie, I guess, but it sounds horrible. And I'm not saying this, hopefully, out of conservatism. I mean, I would love it to work, but I don't think that would ever find acceptance.
So you would have to add a verb, like I'm going on vacation.
Exactly. Yeah, actually, there is an English word. I've got holidaying. I didn't realize it when I gave the example, but holidaying is an existing word in English.
Or vacationing.
Or vacationing, even. I didn't know that. Yes, it's a good example, then, of what English can do and what Dutch what to my mind anyway, other people may disagree, would have trouble accepting that word.
The more languages you know, or know how they work, the more you see these things, patterns and possibilities in other languages that you may not be able to reciprocate in your mother tongue. Gaston's really good at this. Of course, how he thinks about languages depends on his relationship to each of them. He's more analytical about languages he learned at school and college. But for his mother tongue, or tongues, Limburgish and Dutch, well, the words, they just come out. He's not analytical about them, which means he's much less aware of what he's saying. Like with pronouns. Dutch is one of those languages where nouns and pronouns have genders, masculine, feminine, or neuter. But a linguist, Jenny Audring, she recently found evidence that a gender shift is taking place in Dutch, and most Dutch speakers, including Gaston, weren't aware of it. What Dutch speakers believe they say is when they use pronouns, he, she, and it, they use them in agreement with the genders of the nouns in question. Here's an example. The Dutch word for glass, its gender is neuter. So if you're following the grammatical rules for gender agreement, you'd refer to that glass as it. Likewise, the word for cup is masculine, so you say he. Feminine nouns become she.
This is the theory. This is the system on paper. This is what we think we do. But what Jenny Audring discovered in her research is that we use, well, the equivalent of she only for females, women, girls, etc. And some animals that are very obviously female because we know them personally, you know, like your cat, or if you're a farmer, your cow. As a farmer, you know that a cow is a female.
That's kind of it for the she pronouns nowadays. The Dutch just don't use she for other words, even when the gender of the noun in question is feminine. And guess which pronoun is taking over? Yep, he. Draw whatever conclusion you will from that. He is used for pretty much all things and objects, whatever their gender. The Dutch call all of them he, or as they say in Dutch, hey. He has become the Dutch it. Except that Dutch already has an it. It's the neutral gender. And these days, just like the feminine gender, it's not being used very much. This gender shift, and it's only happening in speech, not in writing, it's unconscious. More than that, the Dutch are in denial.
People get caught out referring to a glass of water with he instead of it. And when you point that out to them, they will say, oh, sorry, my mistake. I normally don't do that. Actually, they do that all the time.
And so does Gaston, as the linguist pointed out to him.
She would occasionally say, heard what you just said? Ah, yes, right. And at first I too said, I don't normally do that. And then after the fourth time or so, Well, I could not pretend that was true. I mean, she was absolutely right. Very embarrassing at first.
This all makes it a bit difficult, Gaston says, to write in a natural way. If you write according to the way that people have started to speak, it'll be pointed out to you that you're violating Dutch grammar. Let's give the Dutch a few hundred years to work this out. And in the meantime, Gaston can write in Limburgish. Or at least sing in his native dialect. I'm betting that, except for very few of you, this is the first song you've heard in Limburgish. Gaston wrote it, and this is him performing it for me in his living room in Amersfoort in the Netherlands. Thanks to Gaston and that latest book. It's called Lingo, A Language Spotter's Guide to Europe. A bit more of the song right now, and then Klingon. Leg mich hoed en zeg mich dan, waarom wilt deze man er van zijn leven niet vandaan? Leg mich hoed en zeg mich dan, waarom wilt deze man niet meer uit Amsterdam vandaan? Nina Polzuki's here now.
Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Nina.
I don't know about you, but Lindbergish kind of sounds like a fake language. I mean, when you put an ish at the end, it just kind of feels like, is it a language? Is it not? Lindbergish?
I know, it sounds like this Elvish.
Yeah, Elvish. Yeah. Yeah. Sort of a language. I don't know. That's also maybe how it's just pronounced.
And I must admit, I was really taken aback when Gaston told me a million people speak it.
A million people.
I mean, it is widely spoken. Well, speaking of fake, take a listen to this.
Klingon Kolyet Karma, Shukwit Kolyet Jad. Klingon Kolyet Karma, Rekut Leshkach Bad. Kok me Porshmo Kol.
So a real fake language now.
Yes, a real fake language. This is, I don't even need to say, this is Klingon.
Right. It actually kind of reminded me of going to like a church or going to like a synagogue where everybody's singing a language that you don't really speak. And it just sounds like English pronunciation, but with the foreign language. That's what Klingon kind of sounded like to me. A bunch of people who actually speak English saying words.
Yeah, these are clearly all KSL people. Klingon as a second language.
Klingon as a second language.
So Klingon. For anyone who doesn't know, this is a language invented by a linguist for a movie, a Star Trek movie.
Right, right.
Totally fictional language. But that was a few decades ago. And the interesting thing about Klingon is that, as with these singers, it's taken on a life of its own.
With language like courses to learn Klingon, proficiency exams, the whole works.
People making up new Klingon words.
Everything.
Which is why it's having this little moment in the courts. Who owns it? Who owns Klingon? Mm. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But before, I thought it would be fun to hear just a little bit of a conversation that I had a few years ago with Erica Ockrent. She's a friend of the pod. She wrote a book called In the Land of Invented Languages. And just to set this little segment of our conversation up, we were talking about two types of invented language. There are these languages like Klingon that are created as fictions within, you know, a book or a movie or what have you, like Dothraki as well from Game of Thrones, or the Elvish languages from The Lord of the Rings, whole bunch more of them. That's one type of invented language. The other kind is the, and I put this in quotes, the real invented languages, like Esperanto.
Uh-huh.
Which come from a very, very different impulse. They're created usually out of some kind of dissatisfaction with natural language. Like English doesn't do it. French, you know, whatever your mother tongue is, it doesn't do it. It doesn't convey what you want to convey. So you have to make something else up that is supposedly better.
To unite the world.
In the case of Esperanto, or just to convey something or other. And so here's Erica explaining just how different these two types of languages are, the fictional languages from the idealistic ones that are so mistrustful of natural languages.
Yeah, languages like Klingon or like the modern Conlangs, these artistic languages that people create, have quite the opposite reasoning behind them. They're sort of testaments of love for language and the strange and inconsistent things they do. So Klingon collects all the most exotic features from natural languages and uses a totally bizarre and rare word order and sounds that you wouldn't normally find together in natural languages and mixes them all up into something that's coherent to a linguist. It looks like something that could possibly exist, but something that would be very strange to find in nature.
Well, you start the book and you end it with scenes among speakers of Klingon. We should maybe just point out at this point that Klingon, where it came from, is Star Trek. It was conceived by a linguist who was contracted by Star Trek to do this. So this is, you know, non-human characters speaking on a screen in a fantasy, in a sci-fi fantasy. And lo and behold, people who are watching this, people largely in America, who have taken Klingon on, and they're running with it. They have conventions and they have exams, and you joined them. You went to a Klingon convention, so people around you were not only speaking Klingon, but in some cases they were dressed up as Klingons, as monster type warriors. And it was at that convention that you took a Klingon proficiency exam. And I wonder if you'd read an excerpt from the book about that.
Yeah, this was my experience studying for this Klingon exam, which I wasn't expecting to do when I went into it, but I got drawn in by the challenge of it. So I had to learn 500 words really quickly when I got there, and I made flashcards. So flip, 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 the flashcards flashed. In my room at night, while everyone else hung out at the pool, I sorted them into piles of 10, only moving on to the next pile when I had one fully memorized. In the lobby, after the sing-along and before Klingon Pictionary, I had people quiz me. At the old spaghetti factory, while we waited for a table for 18, I badgered Louise, who frankly didn't seem to be studying hard enough, into reciting my intra-Klingon word associations with me. Wiv, tiv, yiv, choose, enjoy, chew. I choose to enjoy to chew. By the afternoon of the test, I was feeling burned out. My head was swimming with what were essentially useless nonsense words. And some of the Klingons were getting on my nerves. Did they have to be so weird? Did they have to be so weird in public? At a small Thai restaurant that we practically took over during the lunch rush, I shrank in my seat as an exceptionally polite waitress patiently guessed at what my costumed table mates were pointing to when they insisted on giving their orders in Klingon. I wanted to meet her gaze and apologize with my eyes, but she was too rattled by the experience to look my way. Later, as the group made its rubber-foreheaded, vinyl-gloved, wool-caped, guttural Klingon-speaking way toward the door, with me ineffectively hiding behind my hair, I saw a table of cute teenage girls mouthing a silent chorus of, "Oh my God." I have to say, it stung.
Wow, thanks very much. I mean, you do not shy away from the freak show aspect of this in that description. But you also, in many parts of the book, mount a very spirited defense of people who do learn these languages.
Yeah, I found it very strange of the angry reaction they get from people. Why are you studying this crazy made-up language when you could be studying a real language? Why are you wasting your time with this? We waste our time doing all kinds of things. And this is just another creative endeavor, a way for people to socialize with each other, doing something interesting with language. It certainly is interesting, whether or not it's useful for anything. And I got to say, I gained a bit of respect for just the sheer bravery it takes to do this and not care what anyone thinks of you. We could all use a little bit more of that.
Erica Ockrent, she's author of a really fantastic book, In the Land of Invented Languages. And that was just a short excerpt from a long, very fun conversation that she and I had a few years ago when the book came out. I'll post the podcast episode with the full conversation at pri.org/language. But Nina, you've read this legal brief that was filed recently on behalf of the Klingon language.
Klingon language, yes. So there's a lawsuit against Paramount, who is trying to claim that they own Klingon, the language.
And based on?
It was created for them for a film, for a Star Trek film.
So they paid this linguist.
So they paid this guy, Mark Ockrent, nothing to do with Erica Ockrent.
Different names.
Different name. Yep. But he invented Klingon in 1984 for a Star Trek movie. The very first movie, the language wasn't actually created with a grammar and the whole system. It wasn't quite a fully fledged language, but it eventually got that way. He didn't actually invent it, which is really funny. In the amicus brief that was submitted by the Language Creation Society, who are kind of like, wait, 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 Paramount, you can't claim a language. They actually have a footnote saying that Mark Ockrent, he didn't invent the language. He received the language from a captured Klingon named Maltz. So it actually came to him from a Klingon. So therefore, did he invent it? I don't know. So there, Paramount's claiming you can't use this language. It's all surrounding this fan fiction film called Axanar, which is using or wants to use Klingon in the film. So they're saying, no, you can't do that. It's our language. We own it. and the Language Creation Society, which is headed by a very interesting man who you've interviewed.
David Peterson.
David Peterson, who invented Dothraki.
He was on the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, his organization is saying, no, you can't own a language, you can't copyright a language.
Yeah, I mean, this movie being made by Star Trek fans, that sounds all great, but that's a commercial enterprise, isn't it? I mean, isn't that
right
part of the issue with the language? I mean, it's clearly, it seems completely absurd that anybody could lay claim to a language that has since developed
right.
and people have added to it. But if you're using the language to make a ton of money, which potentially, I suppose, this could, you could see that Paramount might want a piece of that, or they may want at least to have an agreement with the Trekkie fans.
Right. I mean, that's a very good point. But I think what they have qualms with is taking their world, too. It's not just the language is part of this whole world. And you cannot just, you know, steal somebody's world.
So there are Klingons who appear.
Like, you can copyright the world. Yeah, if Klingons appear. I mean, truth be told, like, you know, I don't know that much about Axanar, the film. But it goes into, like, Paramount owns this world.
Right.
How do you regulate that? But yeah. It would be one thing if it was just this, like, enclosed, encapsulated world. But this language is not something that lives and dies on the page. It actually has, you know, thousands of people who, quote unquote, speak it.
Okay, that's a really interesting point. You said people who speak it. I saw a quote in one of the news stories about this. A Paramount lawyer said it's absurd to say that Klingon is a natural language because it would require Klingons to be speaking it. And we all know that Klingons don't really exist. And
does language have borders? Does language only belong to, like, one person, like, or one whomever invented it? Is the language the owner? Like, if you're not a Spanish person from Spain and you speak Spanish, you know, Spanish, does that mean you can't?
It just made me laugh so much.
Yeah.
Because we're not talking about people here.
No, we're talking about Klingons.
We're talking about fictional monsters.
Right. But language has a life outside of these fictional monsters. Like, it has, like, sort of...
I would love to hear from any Klingon speakers who may listen to the podcast
yeah.
to tell us whether... Because, I mean, from the excerpt from her book that Erica read to us, conversation was taking place among people who were dressed up as Klingons. So what happens when they take the gear off and they look more like you and me?
Humans.
Can you still sort of be Klingon? Because Klingon, as far as I understand it, is a state of mind as well as a culture and a language.
But I don't think you need to be one thing to speak a language, right?
You can be whatever you want. But
right.
What's the tipping point? Well, there are two questions for me. Like, what's the tipping point for a language that is created
yes.
that then evolves way beyond its original right. creation? At that point, it just seems to be, it's fair game, it's anybody can use it, etc. The other key point for me is this issue of making a film that you might make money from in that
right.
fictional world, and you're going to use Klingon as a kind of prop, then I can see that there might be some argument
right.
against at least paying for the rights to do that.
Well, or at least asking for permission. I mean, I know you can't just rip off Star Trek characters and then put them in a film and make a ton of money for them. So perhaps you can't just rip the language. But there's been lots of examples of Klingon being used in TV shows. Like, there's a whole list in this Amicus Brief, like from in everything from The Big Lebowski to I think that TV show Big Bang Theory. They've used Klingon. Bing, you can look up Klingon translations. But I think all of these institutions, I mean, the make differences, they probably ask for permission from Paramount before just
right.
going ahead and whole,
right.
like, sale using the language. Perhaps this will be an interesting moment, because if Paramount loses control of the language, so to say, like, then it's free game. Klingons, humans, whoever wants to use it for their own means.
Maybe it'll become so widely spoken that poor waitress in the Thai restaurant that Erica was
telling us about,
maybe she even will understand
right.
what exactly it was that all of those people were ordering.
Maybe she will. But from my point of view, I feel like what good does it serve Paramount to own this language? Like, they have now all these fans who are, like, so attached to it that it's become, like, a whole thing in and of itself, and, like, does not add to the mystique and the whole corpus of Star Trek. That's what I feel like a lot about with fan stuff. When you have fans that are, like, rabid, like, attentive, wanting to be there and, like, be part of it, like, is that not good for the brand? Yeah. I just think about like the difference between fan culture here in the States with this copyright issue coming up, and then like, you know, just think about like in Japan where like lots of fringe fan fiction, and it's like a whole accepted, and it's part of the culture. Mm. I mean, it's part of the culture here too, but just like how litigious that got really quickly, like it's just really interesting.
But on the other hand, in this country, we aren't particularly litigious about language, or we don't regulate language.
That's true.
Unlike in, you know, places like France, we don't have organizations that tell us what we can and we can't use that are quasi-governmental and all of that. So should we regulate language at all? It seems as though, like, if the judge here can figure out a way, and not being a legal mind, I have no idea how he'd do it, but if he can figure out a way to tell the fans, okay, you have to reach some agreement with Paramount before you use all of this stuff, but at the same time, make it perfectly clear that the law is not trying to in any way regulate the use of Klingon, of a language,
right,
then that might be a smart move.
Right. You can't copyright a system. Okay, so I'm going to end with this. My favorite line from the amicus brief is, quote, "But as Klingons do not surrender, neither do those who speak Klingon."
I feel at this time I should say thank you in Klingon or something like that.
It's such a fun read. We should put a link on our Facebook page or a link. We'll have a link somewhere.
For sure.
For sure.
So at pri.org/language, we'll link to a bunch of these things, including a post on Klingon that has some comments from the lawyer who filed the legal brief arguing in favor of Klingon freedom. I'll also post a link to Gaston Doran's homepage. You can contact me or Nina at the World in Words Facebook page or on Twitter at LingoPod. If you've left a review for us at iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast, thanks very much. If you haven't, please consider it. At this moment, in this world, this digital world, it is all about reviews. We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.
Het gras is niet vreulig, de lucht is er niet blauwer. En als de zwaak of krank is, geneust het er niet gauwer. De keus is er niet vetter, de luw is er niet wiezer. Dus of ze hier of daar is, is loat voor maar wiezer. Leg me goed en zeg me dan, waarom wilt deze man er nooit vandaan?